Chair.
Over time.
Like the day we had our introductions, I said, you got to.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order today. It's March 26, 2009. We're going to go out of order slightly. We're going to do the last item on the agenda, House Bill 2127. I open a work session on House Bill 2127. Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2127 comes to you from DHS, and it basically allows them to follow the process and procedure that they have been for the last 27 years relating notice in a contested case. We adopted the Dash 2 amendments at the last meeting that we had in this bill on the 13th of March. They should be in your file. We now have the fiscal impact statement, which I think indicates it has no fiscal.
Actually, we'll save money.
Yeah.
Is there any discussion?
Novel.
Mr. Chair.
There's no listening.
I move House Bill 2127 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2127 as amended to the floor of a due pass. Further discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Siegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carried. Is there any objection to putting that one on the consent calendar?
There
you go. Put it on consent. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just real quick, Dash 2s we were ignoring.
They're in already.
We already accepted them last time. Okay, thank you.
We're just waiting for the test call.
All right. Sorry.
Nice to know someone else gets confused.
Hearing on House Bill 2335. And I'll call first Chelsea Spink, Gordon Spink, and Steve Dole.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United, and we're here today in support of House Bill 2335. I have with me a member of Crime Victims United, Mr. Spink, and his daughter, Chelsea, who will speak to you on the bill. I would like to take a few moments, though, and tell you that I have, in the last 2 weeks, attended two parole board meetings, and we do this from time to time at the request of victims or victims' families or the DAs in certain counties to attend these parole board hearings with victims. The one I attended 2 weeks ago had to do with a child rapist by the name of William Hank DeFort. And Mr. DeFort, you might recall, was running the Corvallis Farm Home, a state home for boys at the time back in the 1980s. He'd actually worked there since the 1960s, and he's believed to have raped literally dozens of young men. He was finally convicted when he was the director of the home in 1989 for raping six young victims between the ages of 12 and 16 over the course of during the course of the late 80s, between 86 and 89. Mr. DeFort received a 48-year sentence. And the reason I'm telling you this story is because the victims are very damaged men. They're in their 30s now. And the victims' family, they can't attend these parole hearings, and they had asked me in the past to attend for them and read their victims' impact statements into the record. The first parole hearing for Mr. DeFort was in 2007. I did read a victim's statement into the record at that time, and what I realized was in February, the victim's family called me and said, we're getting ready for another parole hearing. And it hit me at that point how fast these 2 years go by for victims. Because once they start having these exit hearings, it's every 2 years that these hearings come up. And we think this is a bill that deserves your close attention, that for certain inmates who are suffering from extreme emotional disturbances, personality disorders, and others, that we give the parole board the ability to kick their parole hearings out farther than the every 2 years that they take place now. And I appreciate very much your attention, and I will turn it over to Mr. Spinks. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As a brother of a murder victim, I'd like to again bring this bill 2335 into consideration. The victims and their families, and pass the bill extending the parole hearing procedure as far out as 10 years. My family has just gone through this hearing process only 8 days ago. And I am here to tell you we will go back in another 2 years to face the narcissistic man that murdered my sister. And from what my family and I had to go through 8 days ago, we should not have to repeat this every 2 years. Penny was my sister until November 23, 1985, when Lavelle Singleton put his hands around Penny's throat and choked the life out of her. That still wasn't enough. He stabbed her 3 times and then left the scene. After returning to the scene, Lavelle Singleton took a baseball bat to Penny's lifeless body. He beat her face in so much that her mother had to identify her by her feet. We know Lavelle Singleton murdered Penny Young on November 23, 1985. Lavelle Singleton was sentenced in April 1986. His sentence was a lifetime on the Matrix system. Lavelle Singleton in 1990 was given a release date in 1995. Lavelle Singleton was paroled in 1995 with stipulations to the parole. Lavelle Singleton's parole was revoked in 1999 in the state of Louisiana for absconding, which he denies about knowing. Lavelle Singleton returned to Oregon and was back in prison in 2000 because of cocaine use, where his early release was revoked by the parole board. Lavelle Singleton was released again in March 2002. Lavelle Singleton returned to prison in July 2002 for abuse of substance and having relations with a woman without proper consent, failure to report, and lying to his probation officer. Lavelle Singleton came up for parole in 2007, but before his hearing, he was convicted of being an inmate with possession of a weapon and contraband, and was denied parole. I want to make a note as well that the parole board that we had just seen here just a week and a half ago did not recite over his previous releases. Here we are in 2009. As far as I can tell, Lavelle has had 5 chances at parole. The state of Oregon has been very generous in releasing Lavelle Singleton. Twice thus far, Lavelle has not been able to sustain a normal life outside prison walls, returning to drug and abusive nature, let alone inside prison walls. Penny was just 24 years old and had her whole life in front of her. She was active in high school, was an honor queen, and had finished flight attendant school. Her dreams of seeing the world through her career and owning a house at the beach was dashed by Lavelle Singleton just 1 day before she was to move to Seattle, Washington to begin her career. While missing the first 3 parole hearings due to lack of notification, as a family, we went to the hearing on March 18, 2009. We saw the man who had murdered Penny was still the same, unwilling to face what he did, refusing to tell the parole board about his original conviction, thus showing the parole board and his family that he has not been reformed. We wonder why, after 24 years of incarceration, the victim's family should be subject to reopening the wound every 2 years, when it is quite clear that the murderer himself is not ready for parole. Once again, please consider extending the parole hearings from 2 years out to possible 10 years. This would ultimately save some taxpayers money, as well as let the victims and their family rest easier for the longer period of time. I'd like to thank all of you.
Thank you.
And if so, would anyone have any questions as well?
And for the record, that was Gordon speaking. Are there any questions in the committee?
I want to introduce myself. I'm Chelsea Spink, daughter of Gordon Spink. I just want to tell you of what my family has gone through the past couple weeks with the trial of Lavelle Singleton. We've been through a lot of stress and emotions because reliving this murder case of my aunt, my dad's sister, is horrifying. We went through so much having to write the letters and getting ready for this, and I feel that if the bill would make it easier and longer for the prisoners to be in, get parole longer distances apart, that'd be better, and the families could rest and get more time to be at ease. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions of this panel? I want to thank you, and especially thank you, the Spinks, for coming and telling your story today. I know it's very difficult, and here we are reopening the wound once again, but we really appreciate having the face-to-face and having real people in front of us. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just ask one question. Steve, what generally across the nation are other states doing for this type of a situation? I mean, is it longer than 2 years, or is it 10 years?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, or Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I can't give you an answer to that. I don't know. I can tell you, though, that, and I should have mentioned this before, where this arose was, as you remember last year, you probably all remember the Gilmore case, the jogging rapist out of Gresham. And after that case, it's probably no secret, the parole board and Crime Victims United were a little bit at odds, and the parole board, to their credit, called a work group and put together many people at the work group, from prosecutors to law enforcement to the DOC, the Partnership for Safety and Justice. We all sat around the table and looked at what the parole board's functions and methods were, particularly around notification and hearings, and we came to some conclusions about what we should do. It's all in a report that you can read that the parole board, I'm sure, would be happy to provide to you. But many of the recommendations that the work group came up with could be handled through administrative rule. But some of them have to be done through statutory changes. This is one of them. Again, I'm sorry I don't have the answer to that. Maybe Darian Stanford or somebody from the parole board may be able to answer that for you.
Mr. Taylor?
Chairman of the committee, Representative Olson, one of the difficult things in this area is constitutional provisions as it relates to ex post facto. And I believe the -4 amendments have been carefully crafted to limit the chances of this being found unconstitutional. So when you do a comparison to other states, for example, we said if we were to say no parole hearing, that would clearly violate. I believe the -4 amendments put it from 2 to 10 years. The minimum now is 2 years. And where this has gone to the U.S. Supreme Court in a couple of states, they have talked about what are the probability of the person getting out. I believe the -4 amendments take that into consideration. But you remember Darian Stanford from last session when he sat in this chair. He's now in Noma DA's office. I believe he'll talk about that in greater detail.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Stigler.
Right. My only question was, I want to make sure Mr. Dole was on board with the -4s.
Yes, understood. Crime Victims United, thank you very much, Representative. Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, Crime Victims United supports the -4 amendments.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your testimony. Appreciate it. Darian Stanford and Doug Harkle Road, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Darian Stanford, and I'm a Deputy District Attorney with Multnomah County. And last session, I had the privilege of sitting in the chair occasionally that Counsel Bill Taylor is sitting in. Thank you for letting me come here and testify. I'm here to testify very briefly in support of House Bill 2335, and specifically the -4 amendments. Those are the only ones that I believe that we'd be interested in moving forward, because ultimately they appear to be the most fiscally responsible and constitutionally responsible of the various amendments. If I could take just 1 second to let you know, I'm here today because I was involved very heavily with the Richard Troy Gilmore parole case. When I returned, left this job and went back to Multnomah County, that's what I was doing. It occupied about a year of my time. And the parole board is, there's a lot of complexity to it, but this bill is quite simple. There are four types of persons that the board considers for parole, very generally. In some ways, these are might be considered the worst of the worst offenders. The first category are persons that were convicted of felonies and sentenced to prison terms prior to November 1st of 1989, which is when we went to this determinate grid sentencing system. That's the first category of people, and those should be dwindling in number as we move forward in time. The second category are dangerous offenders. Those are people who commit crimes or are found guilty of crimes that seriously endangered the lives of others, and that a psychiatrist typically has determined to have a severe personality disorder that indicates a propensity towards committing similar crimes in the future. Dangerous offenders then are the second category. Third category of offenders that the parole board would consider for release are persons convicted of aggravated murder who do not receive the death penalty, who do not receive life without the possibility of parole. The final option for ag murder is life, where you would then potentially have parole after 30 years. That's the third category, are those persons who fall into that subset of ag murder convictions. The fourth category is persons convicted of murder, not ag murder, who would generally then have the option of parole after having served a minimum of 25 years or 300 months. So that's who we're talking about. Right now, at various places in the Oregon law, in statutes and in administrative rules, once these categories of people become parole eligible, if they're denied parole, they then would be granted a new hearing every 2 years. All this bill does is it says instead of automatically you get a new hearing every 2 years, it's up to the board. Either you're going to get one in 2 years or as long as 10 years. And the board can set appropriate criteria consistent with the Oregon Constitution to decide how long a period of time that should be. Why is that important? Well, it's important for a number of reasons, but the main one I'll talk about is crime victims. During the Gilmore hearing, I sat at a table much like this one, right next to Tiffany Edens, who, as all of you had heard, was raped by Gilmore at the age of 13. Incredible strength of character for her to be able to come and relive what happened to her. But for Tiffany, and for Danielle Tudor and some of the other victims of child victims of Richard Gilmore to have to do this every 2 years, it's not fair and it's not necessary. They shouldn't have to relive it every 2 years. This is a means of making that happen and doing it in a fiscally responsible and constitutionally responsible way. Thank you. Unless you have questions for me, that's all I have at this time.
Very good.
Okay, thank you. Any questions right now? Representative
Barton. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming down, Mr. Stafford. First, let me preface my question by saying that I deeply appreciate the intent of this bill, and I support the intent of this bill. It is unreasonable and indeed absurd that we essentially re-victimize victims every 2 years, and I'm committed to finding a responsible way to abating that. That said, I'd like your I know we're going to hear later from the parole board, but I would particularly like your perspective, Mrs. Stafford. We this legislature delegates an awesome power to the parole board, and I'm concerned about essentially the Enabling Act in here, i.e., that essentially that they can implement the statute pursuant to basically totally undefined rules. And the only guidance for that rules is the Oregon Constitution. Unsurprisingly, that makes me very nervous. That is truly, I think, an awesome, another awesome delegation of power to the parole board. And I'm wondering what, if anything, you think we should or could do about it. For example, the reason we have the sentencing grid, of course, was to try and make stability and predictability in the sentencing. Is that appropriate, for example, with parole? A similar approach?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I understand your question, and correct me if I'm mm-hmm. not understanding it correctly, but as I hear your question, the board is going to be making this determination. Right now, everybody, regardless, gets every 2 years.
Right.
It will be up to the board to decide under this bill, is it 2, is it 5, is it 7, is it 10? Written into the bill is a general principle statement of you may, whatever criteria you use, board, make it consistent with Article 1, Section 15 of the Oregon Constitution. And so that is specifically in the bill. That's also in the board's mission statement. It is the assumption that I would make, this isn't anything in the bill, the assumption that I would make, though, is that, first of all, the board develops criteria as to what's appropriate for release all the time. And we simply have to trust them to do their job and to do their job appropriately. They have the experience to do it. And even though we had disagreement with them on Gilmore, I think they've done a very extraordinary job. Necessarily, some of the people who would be, my take on it, is necessarily some of the people who would be put off to 3 to 5 to 7 to 10 years are those persons that at a particular review hearing the board is going to say, you're not going to be getting parole anytime soon. Mm-hmm. Going through the mechanism of every two years is a waste of our time and your time and tax dollars. So they will be making a determination based on existing criteria to push those people out to help the victims, and because it would be a waste of everyone's time. I know that didn't quite address your question directly, but that's as good as I can do for right now.
No, you did a very good job, Mr. Stanford, as always. For example, when the Congress adopted the federal sentencing guidelines, I think more so than in the sentencing grid in Oregon. But one of the significant reasons that inspired that was, for example, there was found to be significant racial disparities in application of criminal sentencing in U.S. federal courts, as well as essentially socioeconomic disparities. I think that is less of a problem in criminal sentencing in Oregon, in large part because of our grid. And I have some concerns that essentially this totally undelineated delegation of authority to make basically essentially undefined rules might create some problems in that regard. That is not necessarily a total impediment, I think, to my supporting this bill today, but that's something I think this legislature should look at as more data comes in, and I think it may be necessary for the legislature, a future legislature, to better define the criteria by which the parole board makes those decisions by.
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, I believe that the chair of the board, Steve Powers, might be addressing you, and so it would be good to have him respond to that. The other thing that I would say is that certainly I think that people on all sides would be taking a look if this is implemented to see how has it played out in practice, mm-hmm. and it would be very appropriate to revisit things 2 years from now if there are certain disparities that are noted. Chair Barker, if I may, one other point. There was a pending question that Representative Olson had that Steve Dole effectively punted to me. If I may address Representative Olson's question, my understanding is that in terms of how other states handle periodic review, in speaking with Bronson James just now, who you'll hear from, it's generally anywhere from 1 year to every 12 years, depending on the particular state. California, I believe, is every 3 years if certain criteria is met. I believe Georgia is every 8 years, sort of regardless. That's my understanding of the answer to your question.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Denver, I'd step out of the room for a second. Did this bill come out of the parole work group that Mr. Dole referenced?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I actually don't know the answer to that question. I think the idea did, but the bill itself, perhaps not. I might defer to Mr. Harkleroad.
Mr. Taylor.
Chairman of the committee, I was an observer or a participant in that work group, and it was discussed.
Follow up. So there was no consensus that this is the approach to go of all the stakeholders around the table.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I don't know. I would have to defer to, I wasn't on that committee, so I would have to defer to a council or to others that were.
Chair members of the committee, Nancy Sellers is here. She was on that. She's with the parole board. My recollection is it was discussed. I don't remember them making any legislative recommendations. Most of the issues they dealt with were, in fact, all the issues they dealt with were taken care of by rule and regulation.
Okay, thanks. And could I ask one more question, Mr.
Sure.
So I'm very interested in how to improve victim services in the parole setting. I wanted to ask you kind of a related question. Do you think it might be helpful for the district attorneys to have additional staff to notify victims of hearings and to help coordinate communication with victims?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do have a question for you, Mr. Stanford. The amendments reference Article 1, Section 15, which was amended in 1996, if I remember correctly. My assumption is that for offenders sentenced before 1996, prior to the 1996 version of the Constitution would apply. Would that be correct?
Chair Barker, Council Taylor, it's an interesting legal question to discuss. My response would be that it would be appropriate to consider Article 1, Section 15 in establishing the criteria regardless of when the offender was sentenced, because the ex post facto concerns relate primarily to whether somebody, you're increasing punishment for somebody. These are just criteria to consider in setting hearing standards, but that's a very, very short answer to a very, very complicated question.
Mr. Harper.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired district attorney from Lane County, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I'm here today to testify in favor of the House Bill 2335, the Dash 4 amendments. I actually prefer to have the legislature set it out farther, but the fiscal requirements and the constitutional requirements, I think, prevent that. So the Dash 4s are an improvement. All this bill does is give the parole board discretion to set that hearing in those very serious aggravated murder and murder cases somewhere between 2 and 10 years. It's pretty simple. To comment about victim services because of an earlier question by Representative Shields, we ran a victim services program in the Lane County District Attorney's Office. It was on the second day of my first term back in 1985, we set that program up, and we struggled and continue to struggle to have enough resources to do all of the proper notifications and to take good care of victims. So Mr. Sanford's absolutely answer is my answer as well, for a whole variety of reasons on victim services. The reason I really wanted to testify about this bill today is because there's a now retired lawyer named Fred Hughey. He and I graduated together in 1973 from the Oregon Law School. We're classmates. We also served in the Lane County District Attorney's Office as assistant district attorneys. We had an office next to each other, if you will. Mr. Hughey was the prosecutor of Diane Downs. Diane Downs is a criminal who killed one of her children and seriously injured two others who now have lifetime injuries. Mr. Hughey prosecuted that case, and I watched him do that. It took a great toll. If you want an example of victim services, Fred Hughey is your example. After the case ended, those children needed a home, and there weren't a lot of people stepping up to take two seriously injured children into their home, and Fred Hughey and his wife Joanne adopted those children. They have both graduated from college, and Mr. Hughey wants absolutely nothing to do with the press or any of the hubbub surrounding this case. And we did the best we could to protect him for many years at the district attorney's office as I would take those press calls. There was a parole hearing while I was district attorney last year, I think it was, might have been the year before, that kind of runs together. One of our assistant district attorneys, Paul Grabner, had been assigned to manage all that litigation when Fred was retired and long since retired. And so we wrote an extensive letter summarizing and doing a bunch of research on Diane Downs. And this is a lady who should never get out of prison, in my opinion, and our letter supports that with great detail. We don't think the parole board should consider Diane Downs in 2 years. It should be much longer. And I'm happy to let those people who work very hard make the discretionary decision about that as to when that hearing should be held, knowing all of the details and the past circumstances and how she escaped from prison and got pregnant and had a child at state expense, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And so we're strongly in favor of the Dash 4 amendments. Now, regarding the discretion of the parole board, if I might just mention that, it is not uncommon for the legislature in the state of Oregon and all around the country to grant great powers of discretion to the executive branch. And so, as a longtime district attorney, I exercise huge grants of power from this legislative body and did it as best as we possibly could do it, and that continues to happen all around the state on a regular basis. This grant of power, while is a significant grant of power, pales in comparison, in my mind, to the grant of power you give district attorneys to review and decide whether or not they're going to prosecute somebody for murder, aggravated murder, rape, robbery, or anything else. And somebody has to make those decisions and exercise that discretion. So it doesn't bother me. As in fact, I'm very comfortable with letting the parole board make the discretionary decision about is it 2 years, 3 years, five, up to 10 years. And so I would suggest that this is a good approach for the legislature to take. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Smith.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with deep respect to the victims, I know that's felt by everybody in the room, not to mention everybody on this panel. And I hear your good point. And I think I want to say for the record, it is also almost exactly the kind of power over the last several years we have been removing from judges. And to say that a parole officer is better suited to exercise discretion over the length of sentences than a judge, I think, is the kind of policy choice that if it was presented that nakedly to us, we would make a very different choice. And I'm not trying to opine either way on the bill. I appreciated Representative Barton's courage in asking his question. I know it's very hard when we hear from victims to say anything other than whatever we can possibly do to help you, we want to do it this very instant. And I want to say that I think we should be careful about how we grant exercises of discretion and where we are with our left hand taking from judges when we want to grant with our right hand to some other branch of government.
I'm not sure, Chair Barker, if that was the question.
You can respond.
Representative,
this is just a clarifying question about the scope of the bill with the Dash 4. Mr. Hawker wrote, I thought I heard you say this applies to ag murder. It goes beyond that, though, doesn't it? Won't this apply to more categories?
It would apply to dangerous offenders also.
Yeah. Using counsel on my left, Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, it applies to aggravated murder and dangerous offenders.
And could you tell us more about what dangerous offenders? I'm sorry, I know this is somewhat repetitious, but I'd like to just hear it again so I'm clear.
There's a provision in the law that allows a judge to sentence an individual as a dangerous offender and give them additional time if they make certain findings. And so that can happen on any serious felony. I don't have the statute here in front of me right now. But that's the basis of it. I think Mr. Sanford has a comment, too.
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, it is a dangerous offender is an actual legal term of art, and to be classified as such, you have to have committed any Class A felony or any felony of any type that seriously endangers the life or safety of another. And then on top of what would generally happen is the state would give DO notice, dangerous offender notice. If a person's convicted, then there would be a later hearing, and you would have various psychiatric reports to determine then the next phase, which is, does this person suffer from a severe personality disorder indicating a propensity to commit crimes that would seriously endanger the life or safety of others? That's how you would get a person classified as a dangerous offender. My recollection is that Richard Troy Gilmore was classified as a dangerous offender.
Follow up, please.
I think this is just a reflection of my unfamiliarity with this area of the law, but I'm trying to reconcile what you're saying with the language in the dash 4, where section 1 refers to persons convicted of aggravated murder or murder or denies parole to a prisoner sentenced for a crime committed prior to November 1, 1989. To me, that literally reads more broadly than what you're saying. And I'm sure you're right, but I'm not understanding why you're right.
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, with just a very quick answer to that is that the dangerous offender provisions are found separately from what the act murder and murder provisions are. They're in various chapters of the Oregon Code. One is Chapter 144, others are Chapter 163. So it's reflected in different places. I'm happy to speak with you afterwards if you want to go through that, but I understand your question.
Representative.
Thank you. I just want to be real clear here so that there's no misunderstanding about what this bill is trying to do. It neither expands nor contracts the classification of offenders who are currently subject to parole, correct? Nor does it impose any additional nor does it take away any additional judicial discretion in any of the sentencing process. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
You're talking about a class of offenders who are currently subject to the parole statutes, and what we're trying to do here is determine, rather than have an automatic reoccurring two-year cycle when once they become eligible to be considered for parole, which is that it's going to be determined based upon what their sentence is and their classification. Is that correct?
Yes.
So once they become eligible for parole, what we're trying to do through this is rather than have the existing every two-year automatic review come up if they're not granted parole at the time of their parole hearing. So assuming that doesn't happen, that what we're doing is instituting a process by which the parole board, in addition to having the discretion of whether to parole them or not parole them, makes a decision, has a discretion to determine when in that 2 to 10 year period of time their next parole hearing would occur. Am I correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stiegler, and then Representative, go ahead.
Chair. Oh, thanks. Mr. Chair, I did notice that there were representatives of the media here, and I think what sometimes gets lost in this discussion is that the public doesn't understand that we essentially got rid of parole in 1989. Am I correct in that? And that most of the offenders now are not eligible for parole but are released on post-prison supervision. And I just, if anybody's writing a story on this, I think that's just important to have on the record.
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, you're absolutely correct. When we got sentencing guidelines in 1989, we switched from parole to post-prison supervision. So that was the reason Mr. Sanford's comment about those before 1989 are going to be getting fewer and fewer. And that is an important distinction.
No further questions. Just for the record, it wasn't the legislature that changed the judicial discretion on sentencing. It was the voters of the state of Oregon, and when they were offered a chance to repeal that, 75% of them reaffirmed that decision. Thank you. Thank you, panel. Mr. Rogers and Mr. Powers, please. Remember to identify yourself for the record.
I can jump in. My name is David Rogers, and I'm the Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Just to say that Partnership for Safety and Justice advocates for more effective public safety policies, and we're unique in the fact that we work not only with system stakeholders, but we bring together people who are most impacted by the system. So that includes survivors of crime, people convicted of crime, and the families of both. I think that in this instance, in this bill, that actually provides us with a really useful perspective, because this is actually, although what this bill does is simple, it's actually a complicated issue. And I'm hoping to explore actually a range of all sides so that, because I think this is really, it demands careful deliberation. And just to be clear, I know that there are fiscal concerns. I know that there are some legal concerns around this bill, and I'm actually not going to speak to either, but really to focus on how it is this we can move forward if you decide to move forward with this bill that actually best meets the needs, not only the goals of the parole board, but also the needs of both victims and offenders under the purview of the board. So, and I'm going to focus on the amendments and not the bill, the original bill itself, because I think that it's clear that the original bill had a bunch of problems with it for most people who are paying attention. So I wanted to say that there are very strong reasons to provide the board with both some flexibility in deciding the time limit between review hearings, but there's also some strong reasons to explore limiting that flexibility. And it's worth mentioning that currently the parole review board, the parole board review hearings are the only source of contact between the parole board and the offenders under their jurisdiction. And so regular and frequent hearings are valuable to allow the board to communicate with offenders and to provide actually feedback in regard to their rehabilitation process. And in fact, if we want positive outcomes in regard to offenders' rehabilitation, that we want a high level of communication between the board to be able to provide them with feedback around what they actually need to do to be able to head in the right direction. So with that in mind, lengthening the time between review hearings can make it less likely that we actually see positive rehabilitation outcomes. I just want to quickly interject that I had a copier problem, and so I will be distributing via email later this afternoon written testimony. I apologize for not giving it to you now. But lengthening the time between review hearings can make it less likely that we actually see positive outcomes because offenders aren't getting regular feedback from the parole board. It's also worth mentioning that the length between review hearings can be an issue of fairness. So people under the jurisdiction of the Board of Parole have committed very serious crimes. They've already spent actually a considerable amount of time incarcerated, usually at least 20 years. If an offender is earnestly working to right themselves, increasing the time between review hearings can be unfair for them, knowing that 2 years is a significant amount of time for people who are working hard. And within that time frame, you can, in fact, expect meaningful progress in terms of people's positive transformation. At the same time, I think it's worth acknowledging that some offenders are either uninterested in positive change or, in fact, they're significantly challenged in regard to severe mental health issues. So in that respect, actually lengthening the time between review hearings can either serve as some level of motivation for those who have been uninterested in the rehabilitation process, or is actually just a realistic assessment based on someone who is clearly not in a position to be in a different place within a short amount of time. That being said, we actually can understand that in those instances, there can be some value for giving the board some flexibility, although we do believe that the criteria for which the board uses to determine the length between review hearings should be incredibly clear, and of course that criteria, as noted by Representative Barton, isn't laid out in the legislation. And we also think that the time limit should be reasonably capped at 5 years, not 10 years. And we believe that the maximum amount of time between hearings should be capped at 5 years for two reasons. First, 5 years is a significant amount of time, and even people who have real challenges can show progress within that amount of time. Second, it's important to repeat that the only time that the parole board actually has any sort of contact with the offender under their purview is at those review hearings. So in that context, extending the time between hearings for too long, longer than 5 years, makes it actually highly unlikely that any useful feedback or input has been provided to that person. And so therefore, in some ways, by by not capping the time longer than 5 years, we're almost actually making the rehabilitation process impossible because those people are not getting any useful feedback. And so promoting the process that focuses on rehabilitation is something that we're looking for, and we don't want to stifle it. And we think that the 10-year limit is proposed in the amendments is actually extreme and unproductive in that context. At the same time, we also really want to make sure that we're considering the victim's perspective in this process. And being victimized by a serious violent crime changes a person. And unless we've experienced it ourselves, few of us can imagine having a loved one murdered or actually being violently assaulted. And with professional assistance, many victims can actually integrate that crime as part of their life story in ways that the trauma is significantly reduced. But we recognize that when these hearings happen, victims can feel as if the crime is happening again in the present and not in the past. And victims can feel overwhelmed, afraid, confused, and out of control. And so unquestionably, we need to recognize that these parole hearings can be a very difficult process for victims to go through and can be re-traumatizing. And so in that instance, we want to say that when the parole board has reasons to lengthen the time between review hearings, as I earlier noted in the two instances, we recognize that one of the important benefits is that we're sparing victims that re-traumatizing experience. And absolutely, we should do what we can do to minimize the trauma that victims experience during the parole board process. We also have a very difficult balance to achieve. And people who are under the purview of the parole board have been incarcerated for 20 years or more in many instances, in most. And so coming to terms with the potential release of an offender is no easy task for victims because it's likely to bring up concerns about safety and concerns about justice, but it's also a necessary process that needs to happen. And, you know, victim service providers will say that victims whose offenders have been paroled, it usually takes between 6 months to a year for someone to feel, for a victim to feel safe. And ultimately, we believe that the critical issue here for victims is less about the interval between the review hearings. It's more about actually a lack of support services. The parole board currently has one staff person dedicated to providing support to victims in the process. And I just want to be really clear that the parole board has a thankless task. They work very hard. They're really committed to victim notification support, but the capacity isn't there. They've got one staff person, and the lack of services is pretty profound. And I think that there's been a regular dynamic where we can lengthen sentences in the name of crime victims and then feel like our job is done. But at the same time, the things that are particularly important, access to information, a voice in the process, restitution, are not provided. And victim services go incredibly underfunded. You know, just in the past few months, we've generated over 1,000 emails from our members to protect the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, which is proposed to be cut. And just last week, I found out that Multnomah's Victim Services Manager Bob Robinson is being laid off next week, and that's really just an indication of how little services we provide victims in the community and through the justice process. And that's and so although we need to make the parole board process less traumatizing, we need to not forget that there are other ways we can provide support that often and we don't show that commitment. So two other quick points, which is that, you know, the parole board asks very difficult questions when making a determination around whether or not someone is ready to return to the community after serving a really long time in prison for committing a very serious crime. And unfortunately, the prison system is more focused on warehousing people than offering useful rehabilitation programs. And so, and that statement is really based on the fact when you look at the disinvestment in prison programs in Oregon over the past 10 years. And so we need to change that reality, because the people who are under the parole board's jurisdiction have really little to work with and little opportunity to show their progress to the parole board. So briefly, in summary, we believe that some flexibility to lengthening the time between the parole board review hearings could be appropriate. In some instances, that flexibility could provide needed incentive for people to promote rehabilitation. It could allow a more realistic review period for offenders who are seriously challenged through mental health issues. And it also spare victims the needless process of trauma. At the same time, we expect that the criteria for considering that increased length of time from 2 years and beyond should be clear. And at this point, it's not clear. And also that the hearings actually should, the length of time between the review hearings should be capped at 5 years, knowing that if the only contact between the parole board and the offender is at those hearings, we want to make sure that there's semi-frequent 5 years, more than 5 years seems like an awfully long time between actually providing feedback from the parole board to the offender as what they need to do to get on the right track. So it's a complicated issue, but we're generally in support of this bill with a change from moving to 10 years to 5 years, and we appreciate your careful deliberation on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Powers.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Stephen Powers. I'm chairperson of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm here in a neutral capacity and to provide you background information on House Bill 2335 and its amendments. The board, and this has been gone through earlier today, but I wanted to clarify that the board has release authority over about 10% of the population of the Department of Corrections. We categorize those, our population that we have release authority over, in three categories, and it's offenders who committed their crimes before November 1st, 89. It's not when they are sentenced, and that's a critical piece for those cold cases that are being solved or have been solved recently, and it's for a crime that was committed before November 89. We still have release authority over that person, even if they come into the Department of Corrections tomorrow. The other two categories are not dependent on when they committed their crime, and that is the dangerous offender enhancement, and basically that is going from in our present sentencing scheme or framework from a determinate sentence to an indeterminate sentence, saying you have to see the board before you are released instead of a calendar or a guidelines grid determining when your release is going to be. And then those who are convicted of aggravated murder or murder, they also under present law have indeterminate sentences. They need to see the board before they are released, and that was true before November 89 as well. So those three groups make up about 10% of DOC's population, and that's who we're talking about with respect to these particular hearings. I also want to note that the state and federal constitutions do require that the board apply the substantive law in effect at the time the offender committed his or her crime. Thus, although sentencing policy changes have changed over the years, the substantive portion of the board's hearing is guided not by present-day statutes and rules, but by the policies and choices enacted into law at the time the offender committed his or her crime. That's significant because if the law presumed when they committed the crime that they will be eligible for release at some point, it's generally understood that the state and federal constitutions protect an offender from the state making substantive changes that would affect, that would be to the offender's detriment. The board estimates that it will conduct nearly 400 hearings in the 09-11 biennium. A majority of those hearings will relate to an offender's potential release, and those hearings provide an opportunity for the board to review an offender's history and the offender's current circumstances as part of the board's exercise of its release authority. If an offender is unsuccessful at that hearing, either by statute or by rule, the offender will be scheduled automatically for a hearing in 2 years. That's the 2-year current cycle that we're talking about, and what House Bill Bill 2335 amends. The deferral period for one other type of hearing is set by administrative rule, but it is consistent with what the policy is in the statutes. I won't talk about the particulars of the Dash 3 since that doesn't seem to be at issue anymore. I do have that in my written testimony. And then the Dash 4 is the range from 2 to 10. I will say that the amendments provide that the deferral period will be based on the principles in Article 1, Section 15, protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation. Depending on the specific type of hearing that the board has, the board begins its hearings by asking the offender what brought them to prison. As you might expect, the answer, "I was convicted of murder" or "I committed a crime," isn't the answer the board's looking for. It's at this point that the board delves into the details of the crime to really explore what brought the person to prison and establish a baseline. Among other things, this questioning establishes that starting point in which to evaluate the offender's personal and criminal history and aids the board in evaluating the offender's current circumstances and his or her plans for the future. It also provides offenders opportunities to demonstrate whether they have taken personal responsibility for their decisions and actions and what role accountability plays in their life at this point. That is both accountability for the crime that brought them to prison, but also accountability for their day-to-day actions, how they're doing on work while they're working in the Department of Corrections, whether they're getting disciplinary write-ups. Those type of things are part of the board's hearings process. At the same time, the board encourages victims and their families, district attorneys, and an offender's family and support system to provide information to the board as part of the information gathering process. Statements from these participants may be made in person, by proxy, by telephone, or in writing. Of the 429 hearings that we held in calendar years 2007 and 2008, victims or their representatives participated in 14% of those hearings in person or by telephone. That 14% statistic, however, does not include the number of hearings in which a victim participated by sending a written statement to the board or by contacting board staff for information and updates either before and or after the hearing. In this area, the board averages more than 180 victim contacts each month regarding anything from what's coming up with the release hearing to tell me about the conditions of supervision you're going to be setting, because we set those for everyone whether we have release authority or not. So, it gets down to this. The board understands that the very nature of parole hearings can be highly traumatic for victims and co-victims of crime. At the hearings, the board asks offenders to discuss intimate details of the crimes and at times provide a step-by-step, thought-by-thought account of their actions. Because victims have access to all the written materials that the board will rely at its hearings, victims are confronted with the sometimes gruesome and always life-changing events as they prepare for and or participate in a hearing. And although a victim may not personally appear in person or by telephone, there are those victims who write or choose to talk with board staff, as I mentioned, and they are no less affected by the potential of a hearing to revive the harrowing and distressing events many years after a conviction. At the same time, the board believes in the transformative nature of its hearings. This is one of the few places where offenders are directly questioned about their progress towards reformation and their plans for the future are tested. At hearings, offenders are confronted with the depth and scope of their crimes and called to account for the consequences of their actions. Even though an offender may not be, quote, successful, unquote, at any given hearing, the board discusses its concerns and typically suggests ways in which an offender may want to address their criminal thinking. Ultimately, the Board of Parole is neutral on House Bill 2335 as amended, and I thank you for the opportunity to provide you background information, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Is there any questions for either Mr. Rogers or Mr. Powers? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Powers, how many of the 1,600 inmates who you have some jurisdiction over are dangerous offenders?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, I unfortunately do not have that information on how many are dangerous offenders. We can get that to you. I don't think we have those statistics in there. Of the 1,600 that we have release authority over, I can tell you that the bulk of those are those matrix offenders that committed their crimes solely before November 1st, 1989. I believe that 700 and dangerous offenders and aggravated murderers and murderers are the other part. Dangerous offenders fall into dangerous offender matrix offenders, dangerous offender statutory guidelines, folks, and we've seen both since I've been at the board.
And follow up, so probably on a Measure 11 charges, do they have a dangerous offender designation potentially as well?
Chair Barker, Representative Shields, they can.
Yeah.
And because the dangerous offender designation is a sentencing enhancement, you'll go from whatever the guidelines is plus the Measure 11 piece, and it's a 30-year enhancement, and so it's an indeterminate 30-year sentence. We won't see them until after they are eligible for release, after they've served their Measure 11 minimum or whatever the court has set at that point. And then for the rest of that time, say it's, you know, 10 years left, that indeterminate sentence, it's up to us in terms of when they are released and then how long they stay on supervision.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you for the questions. So I hand over here. Okay. Person, Garrett, please.
I guess it's a two-part question. First, as of the current system, are communications between a prisoner and the board limited to the every 2 year hearing? Are there communications that occur in the intervening periods between those biannual hearings?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett. We have, an offender can write to the board and ask procedural questions, and we respond to those. There's also communications in terms of the administrative review process, that is, they challenge a board decision, and we have those kind of communications. We don't have typically the communications of going back and forth of how am I doing, can you review my record. We don't have those kind of communications.
I guess, so a question I have, first, I'll say I agree with the purpose of this bill. I'm just I'm imagining a scenario in my head that I'm trying to understand how this would play out. But say for one of these, for a prisoner who you decide on the basis of a pretty bad performance at the parole hearing that we're not going to hear you again for 10 years. And it turns out that that was a mistake, that 5 or 6 or 7 years later, that is a reformed person. Would there be a mechanism for the board to recognize that and basically undo what had been the 10-year ruling and take more immediate action? And if that doesn't currently exist, I guess the question would be, could you, under this bill, create that kind of a mechanism as part of the rulemaking?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, to the second question, not under this bill, could we engage in any rulemaking to see them earlier, as I understand this framework? Once we have made our decision and made our findings, that is the board's decision. I will say that the board, as an administrative agency and as all administrative agencies, have the inherent authority to reconsider its earlier decision. That is something that the board, like most administrative agencies, doesn't want to do lightly, because if you start reconsidering your earlier decisions, you're opening up a panoply of other decisions. Please see me, please see me, please review what has gone on in the past, and the board isn't set up to deal with those types. And then we also have, do they get judicial review of that piece? And there's currently some litigation around whether there's judicial review of the denial of to reconsider an earlier decision. If I may expand the answer just a moment, Chair, by saying, in exercising its discretion throughout an offender's sentence, the board does have, as was alluded to earlier, as other executive agency officials do, tremendous discretion in terms of those sentenced with life sentences or otherwise. When an offender originally comes into custody, the board, prior to all the guidelines, had its own matrix and would set them and say, okay, you serve 200 months, and then you'll come to the board for your first hearing, and if not, you go into the two-year cycle. The board had the option, under the statutory authority granted to it in Chapter 144, to not set a parole release date, effectively say, we're not going to see you again. Those are decisions that are made within their first initial parole hearing. It's called a prison term hearing. And the board exercised that discretion, and there are people who, what we call parole denied, and they do not come in the two-year cycle. It's not something, and we've had requests, would you reconsider that? Would you reconsider that? And at this point, we have a standardized response saying we're not going to reconsider that decision that was made in 1982, period. And so as we talk about reconsideration, you know, there might be inherent authority, but if it's not written in here, I'm not seeing it as a general matter to provide that framework for revisiting its decision to set at 2 to 10, wherever they're going to set it, the board at that particular time, to revisit that after a certain period of time.
For sure. That's very helpful. And just to make sure I understood you correctly, It's your interpretation of the bill that the rulemaking authority that the board is being given here would not include the authority to create some kind of mechanism for commuting, for a lack of a better word, a decision that we're not going to hear you again for 10 years.
Once Chair Barker or Representative Garrett, yes, my understanding is that as the bill is framed by the dash 3 and the dash 4, that the board will set in the 2 to 10 range or the 3 to 10 range, make findings, and then that's it. And it would have to exercise its inherent authority as an agency to reconsider its earlier decision and couldn't provide a framework as written based on how this is developed.
Next one.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I am concerned about the delegation of what I view to be a judicial function. And I know we do that lots, and sometimes that's okay, and sometimes it isn't. And my comment earlier was not limited to voter decision on Measure 11, but to the sentencing guidelines as a set of policy that is done not only here in Oregon, but federally, where we have decided a set of strictures to tie judges' hands more often, which has many policy benefits, but is a clear choice. And if we make that choice for judges, it does seem that we should be very careful not to apply some of the same principles to folks who aren't judges. And I'm also worried about the litigation that might result. If you're already dealing with litigation under the current realm, if you're doing something that to some might look like a 10-year sentence increase, and I know that's not what it is, but to some might look like, you know, very much a sentencing decision, the litigation that might result. My question is, and because you're neutral to the bill, and it might make you ideally suited or absolutely unwilling to answer my question, which is, should there be, rather than some ex post, rather than some after the fact judicial determination, some, you know, claim to a judge saying what the parole board did was bad, might it make sense to have an ex ante judicial termination of that 2 to 10 or 2 to 5 to 10 or whatever it is, you know, rather than just leaving that with the parole board? Might there be some place to have a judicial determination earlier?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, if I understand the question correctly, whether the judicial department, a judge, would play a role into determining the 2 to 10 period.
Yeah.
I think that's a different framework than how the bill is drafted at this point. And when we go into if I may step back for a second, the criminal justice system starts off in the executive branch with, you know, the prosecutor, goes through the judicial system. The judicial system gives a sentence. That is the executive, when it comes to us, that is our command. For it to go back to the judicial system for findings or for other pieces, I think there might be, it's possible as a framework, but that's extending the piece of how parole has worked previously. It was at parole as a historical component was, we're sending you off and it's up to the executive, the governor, to decide when you're going to get out and how long you're going to spend when you're out. And at this point, if we move that framework into, now we're going to send you back to the judicial system, I think we're creating an entire new different criminal system that's there.
So I hear that answer, and that's helpful, which makes me still nervous, right? Because I still think some judge is going to be hearing something of this, and maybe all they'll do is dismiss it for, you know, lack of a proper forum. But it still seems like somebody's going to be complaining about it if parole officers are being allowed to make a decision between, you know, to make a 10-year decision, and we're never going to talk to you again for 10 years. It's a relatively significant decision. So, but do we know? But you might have an answer that we didn't have earlier, which is, what do other states do? My colleague, Representative Olson's question, which I thought was a really helpful question.
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, if I may first say it's not parole officers who are making this decision. It's members of the parole board that are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. For clarification, the second piece on what are other states doing, what's been represented is about accurate. It ranges from 2 to 5 years, is my experience in talking with other parole boards around the nation, and both the national parole boards of the United States and Canada, and the armies. The military service has parole boards as well. Some go longer to 8 or 10, and some are shorter. As a historical component in Oregon, the dangerous offender review, it has been 2 years, at least since 1955. I had an opportunity to look through some Oregon laws of 1955 as we were preparing for our centennial, as a matter of fact, and saw that was the first time, at least that I could find, that the board was authorized to use a psychiatrist to help its determination at its release hearing. That talked about two-year reviews. Looking at the other statutes pre-1979, there was always two-year reviews as a historical component in Oregon. But again, other states do it differently.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. And just, I'd like a clarifying question on that. So this has come about because of the victims that are coming in. In the past, were victims always included or not?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, victims were not included at parole hearings previously. That is, it's been an evolving piece, and that we are embracing more people to participate in the hearings process, realizing that crime affects more than just a few people.
Thank you. Representative Stegler.
Real briefly, two questions, Mr. Powers. First, the quote-unquote litigation, and I don't know if that was your term, but any kind of, I guess you would say, appeal kind of process, it's internal, administrative, isn't the primary kind of hearings that you have or request in that vein?
Chair Barker, Representative, it starts internally as an administrative review process, but then if they're dissatisfied, adversely affected, or aggrieved, they can seek judicial review by the Court of Appeals.
And then my next question was, how often does that happen?
Chair and Representative, members of the committee, I can't tell you a number in terms of, we average about 4 or 5 maybe where we're opening records and delivering records to our counsel at the Department of Justice. It, as you might imagine, it's for any board decision that we make, that an offender has the opportunity for administrative review and then, if dissatisfied, to go to the Court of Appeals. We make over 1,500 decisions a month in terms of setting conditions for everyone that releases from DOC custody, to dealing with the sanctions that are in community corrections out in the field, issuing warrants, the full panoply of statutory duties. Any one of those can be sought administrative review, and that winnows out some before they get to judicial review. It's a big piece of what the board does is litigation as a part of it, because of the nature of the decisions that we are making.
Review part. And with that in mind, so in other words, there is that opportunity now, and it happens periodically, not 1,500 a month, I wouldn't imagine. Is there any kind of judicial review? That's a periodic, and that avenue is available.
Chair and Representative, yes, it happens. It's not 1,500 a month, but it is, a 30-day sanction decision. People don't traditionally challenge. They do. They may or they may not. If you're being deferred parole, we see a higher rate of those decisions being challenged in the administrative and judicial process.
And you don't have an exact figure at this available?
I don't, and maybe we could see if we can get you a number of open cases that we've had in the last two calendar years.
And then finally, currently you have a say. You indicated in your written testimony or oral testimony that the constitutional basis for principles behind, as you see them, behind consideration that would apply to this 2-year, 10-year as it's currently proposed. Is that the same kind of criteria? Or the same basic set of principles that you have developed the criteria for determining whether parole will be granted or release will be granted or not?
Chair Barker, representative members of the committee, the Article 1, Section 15 principles that I outlined were taken directly from the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. I just set it out of those. The criteria that the board has used or has articulated is very little in terms of most of our hearings. We have relied on the statutory basis for whether we can defer. And so when we look at a matrix offender, we look to the statute, and it says a present severe emotional disturbance that constitutes a danger to the health or safety or of the community. That doesn't say a lot in if you just read it, it's a legal standard that the legislature came up with, and that's what we use. We have, for certain cases, articulated what we want, but we have not put it down in our rules, except for our murder review hearings. But it is consistent with those values that are in the Constitution.
Thank you.
Chairman, of the committee, I just want the committee know that this issue has gone before the U.S. Supreme Court in several cases. One's a Georgia case. And it was a fact pattern similar to this. The Georgia went from 3 to 8 years. It was challenged. And what the court basically said as applied, the question is whether the amended Georgia rules creates a significant risk of prolonging respondents' incarceration. And they basically said, given the respondent's record, the answer to that was no. So obviously one of the key questions here will be, what are the rules? The rules, as I said, the statute was 3 to 8 years, and it gave the board discretion to have a hearing sooner than that, similar to what it's inherent in this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Mr. Rogers, thank you very much.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, Mr. Powers, thank you for your service to our state and the other members of the parole board and your large staff that you have over there. I know how 15. Hard you work and appreciate that. Assuming that in if this was passed and the board could make good judgments as to determination as to this person should be set up for 4 years or 5 years or this person should come back even sooner, how would that change the board's ability from an efficiency standpoint to do what you're called to do and really help with rehabilitation and making sure people get back to where they need to be depending on where they're at that point in time? Can you describe for us a little bit about that?
Chair Barker, representative, members of the committee, I guess I can answer that question in two ways. When we're looking at a hearing, we know it's a binary outcome at this point. You are going to get a firm parole release date or you're not. If it becomes not a binary decision, it is that decision and then another decision of how long we're talking about. That can change the character of the hearings depending on what the members of the board or that panel that are hearing the decision want to do. If they, and those discussions that we have, and I talk about the transformative nature of hearings, I think that could change that piece of it. In terms of if we're not seeing some people, and now instead of we'd see them every 2 years, and now we're seeing them every 8 years, given that they fit whatever criteria that the board has promulgated by rule, then that would free up board member time to do other pieces of reviewing conditions and the other statutory duties that the board does. So that's the sort of the second part of the answer. We have a crushing workload in terms of what the board members are doing from soup to nuts of issuing warrants and talking about some offender who didn't report when they were required to or had alcohol in their refrigerator to going to a hearing in which we're talking about someone using a baseball bat in ways that people shouldn't be using baseball bats. And all of that is encapsulated in the three board members, the executive director and 11 support staff. Not seeing people every so often because they fit that criteria will help some of that workload of the 1,500 plus decisions that we're doing. I hope that's responsive to your question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, I'll call Bronson James, Mark Sussman, and Catherine Myers. As a matter of fairness, I'm not going to limit any testimony, but we are running kind of behind schedule, and so I'd appreciate if you could, if somebody has already said it.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, I'll go ahead and jump in. My name is Bronson James. I'm Chief Deputy at Oregon's Office of Public Defense Services. I'm going to give you two little bits of necessary background to what I'm going to talk about and then get into the specifics of the position of our office with respect to this bill. The Office of Public Defense Services, as you know, has an appellate division. That is the division that I work in. And that division handles both direct criminal appeals and has also been statutorily tasked by this legislature for all appellate representation of all appeals coming from the Board of Parole and Prison Supervision. All appeals for judicial review come through the office and ultimately come through me as I supervise the unit that handles the parole litigation in Oregon. As an initial matter, I want to note and make members of the committee aware that we get a number of requests for judicial review that our attorneys spend a great deal of time talking to the inmates to convince them that the issue is not meritorious and that they should abandon their judicial review in light of that. And we probably make that determination over 50% of those requests, saving the taxpayers of Oregon a considerable amount of money in the cost of litigation coming out of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Now, of course, we don't make that recommendation if we believe there is any meritorious issue presented by that. That's the first caveat that I want to make. The second caveat is this. The impetus for this bill that we should both find ways to increase victim participation in this process while simultaneously reducing the emotional and mental impact that that participation carries with it is a noble goal and one that our office supports and that we believe any one would reasonably support. That must, of course, be balanced against the overall legislative intent of the parole scheme as a whole, which is that, one, we can all recognize, and the statistics bear this out, that for the vast majority of inmates who are incarcerated in the Department of Corrections custody will at some point be released. The question is, when do we release them as a state, and what conditions do we release them under to keep us safe and to transfer some of the economic burden of that monitoring incarceration onto the inmate, because once they're in the community, they can start working and paying for some of those costs. So, and with that respect, I would say that I think the Board of Parole is doing an excellent job. I was, unfortunately, Steve, Mr. Powers didn't mention this when he's up here, but the recidivism rate from board decisions over whom the board has release authority is pretty low. That system that is in place now is working, and I haven't heard anybody here testify that it isn't working. And so to the extent that we can achieve this one goal of increasing victim participation while lessening the impact on them, that is a noble goal. But we must make sure that we can achieve that in a way that isn't destroying a system or hindering a system that we all recognize is working pretty well. So, those two caveats aside, I participated in the parole work group that met, and as was mentioned, this was a group of district attorneys, Department of Justice, DOC, Department of Community Corrections as well, various victims' rights groups, our office, and others. That group developed a report in excess of 150 pages that was presented both to the legislature and the governor concerning a number of recommendations for how the parole process could be re-engineered to be more accessible to victims and essentially function more efficiently across the board. The bill that you're considering today was not one of the consensus recommendations that came out of that work group. And I will point out that there were a number of consensus recommendations, I believe a dozen consensus recommendations, above the non-consensus recommendations that came out of that group. So here's our perspective as the Office of Public Defense Services, our generalized concerns about the bill. The first is we are concerned that this bill has certain constitutional infirmities in it. Certainly, the bill has constitutional infirmities sufficient that we would need to litigate them because there's no way that we could tell an inmate that this was a non-meritorious, frivolous issue that they're bringing up. And even with the Dash 4 amendments, I believe that those constitutional problems still exist. And I would like to specifically address where those might lie, because I think they lead to potential ways of getting around them, should this committee wish to go forward with this bill and perhaps consider additional language in the bill to help it withstand constitutional attack. And Mr. Taylor has referred to two U.S. Supreme Court cases concerning this issue. That is correct. The first is Garner. That comes out of Georgia. The second is Morales. Actually, Morales was first. Morales comes out of California. Both of those involved essentially the same action here. You had a presumptive repeat scheme that was lengthened by either rule or legislation. That was challenged. Both of them went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in Morales affirmed what I believe was a 7-2 decision. 10 years later, Garner comes out, goes a little bit farther, and the majority opinion erodes to, I believe, a 5 or 5, maybe a 6 opinion. In both those opinions, the court was very careful to note why they believed this particular legislation survived ex post facto attack, but also careful to note that simply they were not countenancing a per se change to these parole schemes as no matter what being insulated from ex post facto attack. One of the things that they did notice that troubled them in Morales that was different than the California case. The California case went from a change of parole consideration every year to a consideration of every year, or you could extend it to 2 or 3. The Georgia case extended that to say we're going to go from a 2-year time period to a 10-year time period. That troubled members of the court. The time period that we have in this bill fits within that bill, and so, you know, while it is not dispositive, it is troubling. Secondly, the court noted, I believe, in both of those cases that one of the things they were pleased by the legislation is that there was a provision for an expedited hearing during that interim time. So if, for instance, the person was set out to 10 years, there was a statutory mechanism whereby that individual could petition the Board of Parole for an expedited hearing for a change in circumstance. No such provision exists within this statute. I believe that there was such a provision in the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. They do not exist in the Dash 4 Dash 3. Secondly, the court noticed with pleasure, as far as upholding the statutes from ex post facto attack, that the statutes required a detailed explanation in writing by the board of why the extension beyond the baseline minimum was required. The fourth interesting point to distinguish those two cases, California's change to the parole statute, basically that was essentially California's Charles Manson amendment, and it applied solely to those individuals who were incarcerated for multiple murders. It was the mass murderer provision. So for everybody else within the California penal system, you still had the the repetition of a fixed period of time. But only for mass murderers could you extend this beyond. The Georgia statute applied only to murderers. So again, it was limited to a specific type of crime. This particular statute is not limited by the specific type of crime, and so therefore it encompasses everybody who comes within the board's jurisdiction for release. Finally, and this goes back to a comment you made, Representative Barton, earlier, the court noted, again with pleasure, that there had been legislative guidance to the board in those cases about when the extension would be appropriate. So again, this statute, as you have before it now, is lacking any sort of express legislative guidance by this legislature to when it would be appropriate to extend into that. Now, the reason the Office of Public Defense Services is concerned about the statutory implications of this bill for two reasons. First, that the bill may be unconstitutional, and we do not want to pass unconstitutional legislation. Secondly, we do have a concern to the impact this bill, as it currently exists, with its constitutional infirmities, would have upon our caseload and intake for handling these parole cases. You know, to give an example, Mr. Powers mentioned some of the current legislation about the board's reconsidering prior opinions. I've been handling that legislation. In fact, in March, this last March here, a couple of months ago, earlier this month maybe, I argued what I hope is the end of that case in front of the Oregon Supreme Court. That was in 2009. The case began in 2003. So 6 years of complicated litigation for just that one issue. These changes into the parole law can have a significant litigation cost associated with them because you have a number of prisoners to whom that rule would apply. Those prisoners, as a group of people, I can tell you, are a pretty litigious lot. I suppose being incarcerated in prison with nothing else better to do, they're more than happy to file petitions for judicial review. And we are statutorily obligated to deal with those. And our concern is that this bill, without some more safety measures built in, is going to result in an increase in parole litigation that, to be frank, we are simply ill-equipped to deal with at this point, and represents a financial cost to our organization that I do not believe we currently can bear. So, not being one to want to come with a bunch of problems and not offer a solution, I do have a solution for this committee. First, any of the constitutional infirmities that I discussed or things that were present in those other Supreme Court cases that could be added to this bill, but would certainly be one option. The second option would be this. This is not really part of this bill, but it's something I've wondered about in seeing whether this bill is motivated from. It seems to me equally possible to create a system of parole in the state where we had essentially bifurcated hearings, where the board would hear somebody every 2 years, but they could hear them, perhaps they could even hear them simply on paper. And if the board said, we don't even need to hear from the victims in this case to know there is absolutely no way we are going to be interested in paroling you, they can deny parole. And if the board says, in this case, we might be open to hearing further arguments, then they set their normal hearing, then they invite the victims in, and we have the hearings as we see now. All I'm really offering to this committee, though, is that there are legitimate alternatives to this bill to achieve the same goal that hopefully will not result in the volume of appellate litigation that this bill will. And I encourage the committee to
to consider that, and I'm open for any questions the committee might have.
Okay, I'd like to just have the panel go first, then we'll have questions. Mr. Sussman.
Chairman Parker, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Sussman. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland now. I've been in practice since 1977. My practice is focused on criminal defense. In the recent last 20 years, it's primarily been representing people charged with aggravated murder, serious felonies. I do work at post-conviction, habeas, and appellate levels, state and federal courts. But I have some unique background in that in 1977, I was hired by the parole board as a hearings officer and then to be sort of legal staff to the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards that this legislature created. When we went from a system of purely discretionary parole decision-making by the parole board to one that you've heard reference to the matrix system, which was a system of parole decision making based on the idea of structured discretion. And the idea was at that time was to establish some kind of determinant or predictable system how long people would set prison terms. The parole board's decisions would be based on specific stated reasons and a factual basis for the decisions. It would be structured in a way that would be subject to review. That was the gestation of the matrix system, which ultimately has become part of the we've moved on toward adopting and sentence guidelines. So I want to offer you, and I have that background and experience of working with that and drafting the original rules. And then since then, over the many years that I've been practicing criminal defense, I have represented people before the parole board in a variety of hearings, parole violation hearings, parole consideration hearings, murder review hearings, and for people sentenced as dangerous offenders. So I want to offer sort of the perspective, that perspective. A couple things I think worth pointing out. First, when the system was where we still have the parole board making decisions for people whose crimes were prior to pre-sentence guidelines, and where we have the parole board continuing to have jurisdiction over people convicted of murder where there was an indeterminate sentence or the dangerous offender sentence, you still had kind of an overlay of the concept that there would be some kind of basis of a sort of fixed sentence, and the parole board decision making ought to be structured. Specifically, the dangerous offender people with dangerous offender sentences, pre-sentence guidelines, the board, when they saw them, would set a hearing date consistent with what their matrix or what their prison term was supposed to be. The murder review hearings are set consistent with what the statute, what the legislature has created as the anticipated minimum prison, the minimum term on the aggravated murder sentence. So it was set kind of with those kind of minimums in mind, or that fixed sentence in mind. Originally, the parole board's discretion or the decision making in terms of extending a prison term for people who were subject to be released and facing exit interviews was to be in very specific limited circumstances, but the presumption was release at the time of the end of the prison term. For the dangerous offender sentence, it was, again, to look at whether the person was ready to be released at the time of if the condition that was present, the severe mental disorder was present, was no longer in effect. In most of those cases, what the kind of disorder that we're talking about are antisocial personality disorder diagnoses. Now, that is a diagnosis that applies to approximately 75% to 80% of the inmates in prison. It's a condition which is, as a personality disorder, is mostly, you see, mitigated over time. And when we're taught, and the kinds of people, the clients that I'm representing, the people we're talking about, in who are serving longer sentences, there's a significant reduction of the risk associated with, or the problems associated with antisocial personality disorder that comes with the aging process. Just if I may use an anecdote, but I think a very vivid piece of testimony that was offered by a very experienced, a senior person at the Department of Corrections in one of my aggravated murder trial penalty phases was saying that, you know, we would get people in, you know, young offenders that could be with antisocial personality disorders. You know, when they come in their early 20s, there's a problem. You know, they could be difficult. By their 30s, they're calming down. By the time they're in their 40s, they become the glue that holds the system together. There's clearly an aging process that occurs. And which is sort of built in and recognized, you know, here, to keep that in mind, so that the idea behind looking at this and doing these reviews and assessing these was to see if you had those extreme cases where somebody was still severely impaired and was not ready to be released at the time, consistent with the terms that the law was setting. Now, I say that because it comes back to a concern that I think Representative Barton raised in an earlier question, which is, what are the standards that are going to be used if you extend these terms beyond these, you know, from 2 to, you know, years and beyond? I think that's over the years the trend that I have seen is to erode the specificity requirements of board decision making and more deferral by the Court of Appeals to board reasoning in making those decisions. Also, while there were provisions for administrative review for people to reduce prison terms, the board has, over the years, chosen not to exercise those administrative reviews in many cases. And it's a process which has had its deficiencies, even where there are circumstances where a person could have made a showing that their circumstances have changed and something should be reviewed. I've had cases where administrative reviews of decisions to whether to revoke parole, whether to defer somebody for 2 years, have been pending for as long as the person was in prison, pending their next 2-year review hearing without a decision on the board. So that the administrative review process, where we don't have clear standards, some of the discretionary review processes are without clearer standards, I think create some serious problems and some serious inequities. I would think from the perspective of somebody, again, who's worked with families and people who have been working hard to try to get to the board and establish a basis for release. I've seen what the board's done with in using the hearings as a transformative transformative goal, and I've seen that be very effective. I've seen that, you know, it's something that I've used as a tool in working with clients to prepare for that. However, the longer that time that you put between those hearings creates a couple of problems. First, you don't have counselors, you don't have people in the prison who are working with these folks, you don't have the resources in there to do what Steve Powers was telling you that the board is doing in confronting people and talking to them about what do you need to do to change the thing. So when they see the board, that's the place where this stuff is being addressed. But you delay it, and there's a huge financial impact because the tendency is for people to stay longer, the more you defer that. So the perspective that I had is that I came in with, and I would have asked you to consider that the constitutional concerns that Bronson has raised, I would at one point that I don't think was mentioned that is worth mentioning is that the California and Georgia statutory systems that were reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court both had systems where the burden was on the inmate to show that the person was eligible or ready for parole. We have a system which does the opposite, which has built in an expectation, a presumption that the person would be paroled unless there are circumstances which justify the delay in the release. There are due process considerations or implications of changing that and denying that or extending that, something that goes back to an Supreme Court decision in the 70s of Greenholz versus the inmates in Nebraska Penitentiary, which recognized the due process right to those considerations in the parole process. So I would ask, again, I would endorse the recommendations that if you keep the default at 2 years to avoid the ex post facto problems, if you are to consider and extending, allowing the board the discretion to extend the time to for those extreme cases, for those understandable cases where release is not appropriate. Some of the cases mentioned earlier. You should do what the original statutory provision includes, but put the burden on the board to state specifically what extraordinary circumstances there are that justifies the delay to the later period of time. Specific findings and a statement of reasons. And based on what's done in other areas of the state and the recommendation you've heard earlier, asked you not to extend that beyond 5 years. But also, I think there is no provision now. The board does not recognize under its administrative review process the ability of somebody to come back and say, things have changed, circumstances have changed, that you should consider a hearing in less time. And if the inmate can make that showing, consistent with the provisions that we have in current law for demonstrating a rehabilitation hearing for a shorter hearing, then that kind of provision should be included as well. So that's what I would ask you to consider.
And before you start, we're not going to be working the bill today. And I'm hoping if we get done, we have two more witnesses to speak. I want to have one more bill today, which would be 2335. The other three House bills are going to have to be put off. We'll have to continue them down the road. The Senate bills we probably won't get to until the 28th because our schedule's already really getting backed up. So, please.
Well, this is your shortest testimony. Okay, Chair Representative Barker. My name is Catherine Myers. And I'm a private citizen, but I would like to say that I worked in the juvenile corrections system for almost 30 years as a qualified mental health professional, and I cannot support the House Bill 2335 as written. One of my main concerns are what Representative Barton has brought up as far as the undefined rules. And someone brought up about maybe it could be revisited, if passed, revisited in 2 years. I would hope that there would be some system that would be set up beforehand so that it could be monitored during the 2 years and so that the information would be readily available in 2 years. And finally, my concern is, and what I would ask is that the parole board would continue to work towards a more meaningful hearing for victims and victims' families and for the offenders. A balanced approach.
Okay, thank you. And I'll just public announcement here. I may have said that wrong. I hope I said I'd like to hear 2655 after this, which is a TriMet bill. Questions for the panel? Thank you very much. I really appreciate your testimony. And Mr. James, too, would you second that? Well,
okay.
And I have somebody else who didn't sign up yet who wanted to speak. Please.
Thank you. My name is Mike Huser. I appreciate Chair Barker and representatives the opportunity to speak. I'll be brief.
Thank you.
I have a handout here that you pretty much covered everything that I was going to talk about. It's been a real good meeting, and I think a lot of really important information has come out of this meeting. I would like to say that my heart truly goes out to the victims and their families. And one item I'd like to touch on is it says here that House Bill 2335 was spawned from California's Proposition 9, which was enacted in November 2008 general election. And the California prisoners and advocacy groups have already initiated suits against the Proposition 9. Oregon prisoners, I'm a little emotional. My little brother's been incarcerated a long time, and he's really reformed, and I'd like to see him out someday. Anyway, if this does pass the way it's written, Oregon's going to see a literal flood of litigation. It's going to cost a lot of money. There's people in Oregon that are already anticipating the passage of this bill, and it's going to happen. So the ex facto
You know, I'd like to leave this handout representative shields, and if you folks want to look at it, it's full of verifiable current, and all the sources are noted, and it pretty much goes over everything you folks have talked about, and I appreciate the fact that you...
Well, thank you for coming and giving that testimony. Representative Shields had to go down. He's a chairman of the Ways, co-chair of the Ways and Means,
okay.
And he had to leave.
Right. Can I leave it with someone else that would be interested?
Yeah, if you leave it with the staff,
okay.
And then
thanks,
we'll make sure we get it out. You bet. I'll close the public hearing on House
Chair?
Bill.
I'd like to say on record, first of all, I really appreciate the high-quality testimony we've received. I would be happy to work with the proponents and the opponents to try and effectuate the intent of this bill while minimizing unfortunate consequences, and I'd be happy to work with anyone on this.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2335 and open the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2655.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2655 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary and would basically say it prohibits a person from attaining the property of the Mass Transit District by adverse possession, and the background is the adverse possession statute.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be as quick as I possibly can. For the record, I'm Olivia Clark representing TriMet, and with me is Eric Van Hagen from our legal department in case you have any questions. Basically, Mr. Chairman and committee members, all this bill does is extend the same protection that's afforded to cities, counties, railroads, and school districts to TriMet for adverse possession. The statute is patterned right after ORS 275, which extends that to counties and cities. It's not exactly identical, but almost. We've got lots and lots of property all over three counties and over 20 cities, and we'd like to have the same protection. So with that, I'll...
Is there any questions about that? And basically what they're looking at, they don't want somebody moving their fence down onto, for example, a MAX train right away, and then a few years later saying that's my property because I've been there. Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2655. We don't have a fiscal, so we can't pass it out today. We have to get that back. Any further business? Meeting adjourned.
Sound like Mr. Cole.
Yeah.